It's time again for the Broken Clock podcast. And is this the first one since the U.S. election was called, Mouse? I think it is. I think
I
we weren't
think it
sure
is.
last time. Yeah. So it is the first Broken Clock podcast under the president-elect Biden, outgoing President Donald Trump scenario. And of course, things were okay for a little while. And then the day before we're recording this, there was fighting in the street overnight in the US, which is probably not surprising because of the phenomenon we're going to talk about this episode, cognitive dissonance. Now, people usually think they look up cognitive dissonance and it's like, oh, the feeling of discomfort from conflicting attitudes, beliefs, or behaviors. But it's what cognitive dissonance causes people to do that is relevant from a critical thinking perspective, because the overwhelming desire to stop the cognitive dissonance does not necessarily result in good decision-making. Often all it does is causes people to change their worldview to suit the thing that in their gut they wanted to believe, but is dead wrong. And Mouse and I wanted to talk about that this episode, because all the range of things we were like, well, let's talk about this phenomenon. Let's talk about this phenomenon and why this is going on, why that is going on. And it all kind of came down to this cognitive dissonance phenomenon. And the one that I've been struggling with this week, Mouse, I told you this off air, is the idea that many conservatives have right now is there's a liberal bias that liberals are stealing the election. There's a liberal bias in the media, but systemic bigotry doesn't exist. It's a totally contradictory set of beliefs. And I have no idea how they square this, but I suspect that it's the reason a lot of people are now saying Fox News has been co-opted by the liberals and they're moving to Newsmax. And that's how cognitive dissonance tends to work. It doesn't result in good decision-making because most people don't like admitting that a core belief is wrong. So all they do is change their behavior around the edges to stop the cognitive dissonance, but it's actually making the bad judgment worse, which long-term leads to more cognitive dissonance. Now, Mouse, you deal with a slightly different type of turd burglar online. have you seen, I mean, the cognitive dissonance on the left, just so that we don't play favorites, is or play like unfavorites, is this idea that the government has caused this racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic dystopia in the world right now. It's the government's fault. And so more government is the solution to that problem. More laws, right? More government overreach in our lives. It doesn't make any sense. You know, but people, you know as well as I do, people firmly believe this.
They do. They do not see the Trump. A lot of people do not see the Trump overstepping of the limits of his office, in many cases breaking them. Mm-hmm. As an issue with government having too much power, having the capacity or being given the capacity over decades of progressive overreach to negatively impact the lives of its constituents. They do not see that. They only see the man, the current problem child in the Oval Office. And while that in and of itself is something to concern you because, you know,
right,
a tantrum throwing Montana Max in the Oval Office is not anywhere near a situation any of us should be in, really.
Right.
The issue that they fixate on the man and they think, well, once Biden is in office, a lot of this will stop. And yes, a lot of Trump's worst excesses will stop. However, that doesn't fix the issue that the executive branch and the office of the president have accrued a lot of power over generations. And that means that the office is prime for the next authoritarian, the next shameless populist authoritarian, who is more effective than Trump.
Yeah, I think what's scared a lot of people lately is how many things in the US government were just sort of norms. Mm-hmm. That there was no actual recourse if someone broke them other than being voted out of office.
Right. They were in many ways they were counting on tradition and the tradition of a certain unspoken conduct, code of conduct, the honor system, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, you know, that may have worked fine for a couple hundred years, even though really many times it didn't. If you look at U.S. history, you actually had a politician caning another one to death in the middle.
Yeah. Well, it's beyond that, though, right? There is an assumption in the U.S. system, because you guys have fixed election dates and, you know, 50% plus one or not even of the population of the vote, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody gets 270 electoral college votes. They're the president for 4 years. You don't have minority government situations. You don't have half measures. You've got it's winner take all. Mm-hmm. And
now I have ABBA in my head.
Yes, the winner takes it all. It used to be that parties, that smoke-filled room metaphor, had the ability to kind of quietly sideline a guy like Trump that they knew was going to be bad news. And he might be a popular candidate, but he'd be bad news in office. Whereas now, because everything's very populist and because this very public primary system has sort of taken hold, those checks and, I mean, the US system is all about checks and balances. People hear checks and balances. They recite the idea of checks and balances and separate but co-equal branches of government. But then they want these massive sweeping changes done with one stroke of a pen, everything gets better the way they want it to. And mm-hmm. that's a major part of cognitive dissonance when people approach politics. They keep trying to force the system to do things it's not designed to do. Up here in our Canadian parliamentary system, a party can do that because we don't have the same separation of powers. The head of the party with the most seats forms government, period. We can have a minority government, but, you know, it's much easier to pass stuff. Our, you know, protection of trans people enshrined in law, pushed through by the liberals. Gay marriage, pushed through by the liberals, right? It's not the same in the US. And my big concern with the US system, the greater concern I have over this, both parties seeming to be really big on government overreach, uh-huh. is this cognitive dissonance regarding the system. People can recite exactly how US government is supposed to work, and then they want it to do something it was not designed to do. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
There's a reason that the last kind of truly functional government in US history was the Clinton administration, because it was that slow change, pass small bills, you can actually pass thing. And yes, it resulted in some debacles like the crime bill, right? Mm-hmm. But overall, Clinton was the last president to actually make the system work the way it was designed to work. After that, it got into gridlock and these, you know, executive orders that have left too many policies too tenuous and too many people stuck in limbo.
Mm-hmm.
Which creates
the problem with an objective law.
Yeah, and which creates more fear, which creates greater potential for severe cognitive dissonance and people just wanting to make it go away, doing increasingly absurd things. And so we have people fighting in the streets. I don't know about you, Mouse. I think these people who are fighting in the streets are doing it to fight in the streets. They're not doing it for a cause. Am I wrong?
No, honestly, at this point, you do have a set of the population, a very worrying set of the population, who for decades has been chomping up the bit at the narrative of civil war, and of, you know, being oppressed and being put down. And so right now, this is kind of war theater for them.
There's that, but there's also this Antifa movement, mm-hmm. who enrages me, not because I think they're, you know, horribly dangerous. Data says that, you know, domestic white supremacist terrorism is the biggest problem in the US right now. But it's because, talk about cognitive dissonance. I mean, we know historically that the original Antifa movement actually helped the fascists, mm-hmm. because fascists work through fear. And so the fascist governments that these Antifa types were opposing goes, look at these violent hooligans brawling in the streets. And people who were frightened of the violence just lined up behind a strongman. If you are truly against fascism, why are you doing things that are helping it? Because truly at your core, you want to go out and punch people.
Yeah.
Right? That's a shining example of two things are going on in a person's head. I want to go out and fight in the street, and I know this is actually helping. Well, it's not actually helping. I'm anti-fascist. So as long as I call myself Antifa, which it has the word auntie in it, guys. Like, unless you're showing up in a pink floral dress and pearls, you're doing it wrong. Okay, you should be dressed like a Vicki Lawrence character. Come on, or at least one of the Golden Girls. Cosplay this shit.
But, oh my god!
You know, wouldn't that be cooler? Wouldn't that just make it way better? They're all dressed like old ladies, and they have to hit people with purses.
Well, they first would need to learn how to master the B. Arthur glare. That's usually enough of a deterrent.
And start calling themselves anti-flow. For people who don't know, that's a very old term for getting your period. So, but you see how seriously I take Antifa. Never mind these MAGA idiots, right? Never mind, because they're all just cognitive dissonance. They have very, very strong core desires, core needs, core wants that are out of step with their professed beliefs. And what wins the day in the battle of the cognitive dissonance is those core motivators that need to go out there and scream and yell and hit things. And there's a bunch of people in a lot of places right now not sitting with that and going, why am I doing this horribly self-destructive stuff?
Yeah.
Right? Because eventually these guys all get either beat up or arrested. But that just fuels their sense of victimhood and so on. Like we've got this cognitive dissonance spiral going on. And it's true in Canada here as well. I mean, I got one of these anti-Trudeau types that they jump around from one data point to another data point. Bad, 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 bad. But they don't compare it. One, they don't compare it to past administrations. And they don't actually connect the data points in a way that is salient or cogent, because mm-hmm. they just want to feel a certain thing, and they don't want facts getting in the way of that feeling. Yep. And for some odd reason, people are invested in thinking some latte liberal, out of touch, evil cabal is looking to take over the world. Which, of course, allows the right wing, fairly fascist tendencies to get more and more control over government. I mean, you cannot say conservatism is associated with small government anymore. You can't. Their actions,
not in the US.
Their actions, the conservatives, well, in Canada too, they would love to have the power over the courts that the US does. Our system of appointments is slightly different. So it's harder to politicize in that regard. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this idea that you stack a court to overwhelm the majority desire, the majority consensus of morality regarding things like gay marriage, regarding things like the right to an abortion and all the extended healthcare services connected to that, and so on and so forth. They're using the fact that, you know, what is Wyoming has like 500,000 people and they get as many Senate seats as California that has like 39 million people or something like that. They're using that to have minority dictatorial rule that overrides the will of the people. That's scary. That's not a small government approach. You know, I don't know how that's the cognitive dissonance of the modern conservative movement, right? Freedom, as long as you do exactly what we want. And the sick thing is they don't even really care about those issues. Well, Samuel Alito seems to care very much about the Obergefell decision. I have no idea why. Have you noticed that? All of a sudden, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's not there anymore. Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito all of a sudden like, oh, we found our balls now.
Well, I guess they, I've always suspected they have been rather envious of people who have happier marriages than they do.
Is that what you think it is?
I don't know. The mind of the religious conservative is one of those things that I have yet to really been convinced of the existence of.
I've gotten a glimpse into the mind of a religious conservative.
That's right.
Yeah. It's a ton of cognitive dissonance, but it is essentially, I can't control my own urges. Therefore, nobody else can. Therefore, in order for the world not to descend into a horror show, we need fascist rule. We need tight, rule-oriented controls, because if I can't control myself, no one can. That's the thinking underlying it. And they can talk about freedom all they want. They don't actually believe in it.
Yeah. It does. That pretty much rings true. This is for your own good. You don't get to decide what it's in your own interest. I do, because I have a higher connection.
Yeah. I have this ongoing thing with a guy on Facebook. He's a lovely guy, but it's that religious conservative thinking. And I keep telling him every time he tries to butter me up by small talking, you know, classic video games or something he thinks I like. So he's going to charm me back into being reminded that he doesn't see me as a person because he thinks the state has the right to control my body. You know, but people can still shoot people for coming on their land, right? He admits the dissonance there, but oh my God, killing babies, right? That's why I kind of love what they're doing on The Mandalorian. That they had Baby Yoda eat this lizard person's eggs. There was this mission where the Mandalorian has to transport this lizard woman with her eggs, and Baby Yoda's a walking stomach. And so Baby Yoda got into the eggs and ate a few. And some people online, you know, said, that's genocide. I'm like, what you on? Baby Yoda just abortioned. Like, lady, you shouldn't have these kids. Oh, nom, nom. Like, awful joke, right?
Yeah.
But I'm really quite impressed with Disney for going kind of raw that way. They take this cute thing and make it kind of creepy. And somehow that makes me like it more, because he is a baby, right? And babies put everything in their mouth. But
that's what babies do.
Yeah. And I find it very interesting, another point of cognitive dissonance, that people recognize they can yell at media creators. Mm-hmm. And media creators are relatively helpless to respond because they're all afraid of getting canceled. And so they bully media creators for reflecting reality instead of looking at the things that they're doing in their own lives to perpetuate the very systems they're screaming at people in media for reflecting. And it's one, it's because of this belief that media can somehow hijack your free will, which newsflash, it doesn't. It doesn't matter how often you were taught in high school that it does. It doesn't, unless you have shitty parents. And so you have no moral compass, right? The immediate peer group is, and this was an accidental segue, I think a big reason why a lot of these a lot of this cognitive dissonance happens because a lot of people's beliefs are just based on a very rigid moral purity test among their peers. And if you don't think with the hive mind, and this is true in conservative and liberal circles, you're kicked out. And like that's like socially enforced cognitive dissonance. And that's one of the main causes of cognitive dissonance is forced compliance.
Yeah.
That you're forced to do something to not lose your job or, you know, to not have somebody be mad at you that really doesn't sit right with you. Now, neither Mouse or I are very good at this. I think this is why we get along. Neither of us is someone who kind of goes along to get along. We say what we're thinking and let the chips fall where they may. Sometimes we don't say anything, but not saying something and letting somebody do something that we don't agree with is not the same as being forced to do it ourselves.
Yes.
Right? That's why we're critical thinkers. And I think it is that core, we were talking about this when we were trying to figure out this topic, that core overcoming fear of ostracization response that some people have, some people don't. I'm not sure if it can be taught. And this is where I struggle, because if it can't be taught, we have to remove all the fear.
Mm-hmm.
If it can be taught, different solution, right?
Right.
And I don't know the answer, because I have seen so many people know a behavior is going to get them into trouble, and they just keep doing it because they're trying to get the approval of someone around them. And they feel so victimized, and they feel like they have no friends, and they feel like nobody likes them. And yet perhaps the reason that nobody likes them is they're not showing them who they are. They're just trying to get a set of right answers so they don't get kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what cults do. I mean, cognitive dissonance theory was founded by studying cults. And it, as silly as it sounds, it is pretty much what's going on now with both the repudiation of Trumpism and socialism in the last election result, that both the more left-leaning people politically are trying to come up with all these reasons that socialism wasn't repudiated. AOC made an ass of herself on Jake Tapper's show doing that. There's a shining example of someone who is very smart, but full of cognitive dissonance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she just wants to believe certain things so badly that she looks extremely foolish, even though she's super smart.
Yes.
But then you've got, you know, the Trumpers who are like, the election was stolen. They know it wasn't. They just have to say that because the only reason they liked Trump is because he won against perceived odds.
Mm-hmm.
Even though people with models that were actually based on historical trends predicted he would win.
Yep.
Those are just sort of ignored because people didn't want to listen, right? And this super cultish behavior. So what happened in the original study was that there were one of these, you know, doomsday cults that they predicted a date that the world was going to end.
Mm-hmm.
And then that date came and went and it didn't end. And the cult got split between people who were not as popular within the cult. They were like, well, we've just made fools of ourselves. We're going to go home now. But the people who felt a sense of belonging in the cult, they couldn't do that. So they resolved the cognitive dissonance by insisting that they were right all along, but it was the faith of their cult that stopped some higher being from destroying the world.
Oh, I have that.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the thinking, right? That is the thinking among, I hate to say it, Bernie bros, who can't accept that the world is not down with their beliefs, or, you know, the AOC types or the MAGA types. They're all, our faith in this is the only thing keeping the world together. It would fly apart without us. Therefore, we're not making fools of ourselves. It's the world that's wrong, right? And you talked about this, the idea that the dichotomy between something wrong with me, something wrong with the world.
Yes.
You mentioned this. So can you unpack that? Because I think you have a better handle on that than I do.
Well, see, if it's interesting, because there's a whole different, there's a whole gamut of possibilities with this type of what I call the primacy of consciousness, of the primacy of existence. See, if you believe that you are right, despite all evidence to the contrary, you know, you're not in danger. The world can be wrong. And here's the thing. It kind of harkens to a bit of the, what would you call it? The martyr mentality.
Yeah.
The whole, I am the lone voice of reason spitting against the storm. It is kind of a heroic self-appointment in many ways. It's in fact, it's one of the reasons why conspiracy theories are so popular among people who believe themselves to be completely powerless.
Because you know something everybody else doesn't.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Of course, it follows that if you are right and the world is wrong, then the world needs to change. However, if you're wrong and the world is right, that means you have work to do.
Right. Right. And being wrong, all those little gremlins in your head, then they attack.
Exactly. It immediately starts triggering all of the low self-esteem issues with which all of these conspiracy theorists have. It's the reason why they have gravitated to conspiracy theories, because conspiracy theory kind of occupies, and in many ways a lot, and you'll notice actually that a lot of these people tend to be also very, very deeply religious, at times even fanatically religious.
About something, not necessarily God.
Right.
Yeah.
Not necessarily one specific type of religion or another. But, you know, it's because you have that, you know, you have that notion that something else, something greater than yourself, is here to provide you with what you lack, which is that sense of worthiness, that sense of importance, that sense that you can impact the world.
See, that's interesting that you tied a sense of worthiness to a sense of importance, because they're not the same thing. And I think a lot of people equate those two things at their own peril.
Yes, I had to do work on this myself as an opera singer, because if you're an opera singer, unless you are exceedingly well connected and have a powerful mentor who can open doors for you, you know, your odds at the very beginning and for a long time, and sometimes even forever, remain against you. So you have to face rejection after rejection. Just like every performer, when you get rejected, you run into the danger of going, well, why did they not want me for this role? It's because I sing poorly. It's because this or that. And you start going into all of the reasons why you are not good.
See, that's why it pays, if you ever have the opportunity to be a judge or to be on the other side of the audition process, you are cured of that.
Yeah, because sometimes it really does come down to, and some people who have been judges, who have been part of opera judging panels for auditions, they have said, well, I would have picked you, but the stage director thought that this other tenor would look better in the costume.
Comedy is worse than that.
Yeah.
Comedy is one guy who's friends with one of the guys who auditions goes, oh, come on, he really needs the break. As if that should matter when you're picking the best person for a part.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But it has nothing
to do with skill.
Yeah. If I tied my worth to importance, for example, on the operatic scale, then I would in my mind have no worth because of all of the rejections that you go through as an opera singer. And again, like I said, unless you happen to have that lucky break, like my voice teacher did, she just happened to be, well, my teacher was exceptional. But that's the thing. You have a gigantic number of exceptional people who never get that break.
Right.
he was lucky enough that she was an understudy at the Metropolitan. She'd been understudying for 2 years now, and she was the cover to the cover. And it just so happened that the soprano got ill, and then the cover right. got ill. But she didn't know that. She was eating with her husband because, you know, they told her, you know, act one went fine, just go home. And then suddenly people burst through the restaurant going, you need to be on stage in 15 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, she just knocked it out of the park without even getting a proper warm up. They stuffed her into one of Joan Sutherland's old costumes without even doing the proper fitting because no time.
Right.
She had never rehearsed with the conductor, etc. But, you know, she was at the right time and she had prepared herself enough. She knocked it out of the park and her career, you know, her international career began. But that's not something that happens to everybody. And
putting it lightly. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to realize that, you know, you might train yourself to become a tenor of, say, Alfredo Krauze's level. You know, you've reached that level of technical resilience, you have the interpretation, but the other half of the equation is luck.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot. And you can't tie your worth to matters of luck, like Epictetus, which again, not Epictetus, that's... Yeah.
But think, call him that if you want. Call him that if you want. It's all good. I don't judge.
So Epictetus used to say, you know, you need to realize that there are things in this world that you can change and you can control. There are things that you cannot. And you will be immensely unhappy if you focus on all of the things that you can't change. And if you put your happiness on the, you know, tantamount to these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that. I think there's some of that going on here. And I have something of a crackpot theory as to why. I mean, this is a bit of a critical thinking exercise, right? Because I listen to a lot of people and it's like, wow, they have some freaky views. I wonder why that is. And there is this myth in culture that people repeat to their kids. When they're, you can be anything you want as long as you work hard, right?
Right.
That's not true for most people. Most people will never be president of the United States because you can only pick one person every 4 years, meaning a lot of people ain't going to get picked.
Yeah. Huh?
And, you know, you can be is not the same as you will be. And is it really wise to pursue something, depending on other things that are important to you, that requires, you know, a huge amount of sacrifice and essentially selling your soul? You know, I watched a documentary last night, it was terrifying, about how you cannot get elected prime minister in the UK without Rupert Murdoch's blessing. And that includes Labour Party types like Tony Blair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be prepared to make those deals to get there. And not everybody, most people, I think, can't live with that.
No.
You know, it's the same thing with performing. I think the horror of Harvey Weinstein and the fact that there has been this massive knee jerk is the fact that, let's face it, that exact archetype, that trope of a pervy, grotesque, casting couch motivated Hollywood mogul is something that has been romanticized as kind of a stock villain for some sort of sympathetic female lead to rail against, right? It doesn't work the same way at all. In the real world, he doesn't get his comeuppance because of one person.
Yeah.
Right. He had to be so ridiculous that eventually they couldn't dismiss each individual woman as a liar. There were just too many of them. That's not as exciting as the, you know, the David and Goliath with sexual harassment myth. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are really uncomfortable with how they were, the word complicit's overused, but, you know, it suits here that they, same thing with corrupt politicians, right? Like, I never understood the appeal of House of Cards. To me, I think House of Cards just gives people moral permission to prop up politicians they see are corrupt, because they just assume that everyone is corrupt. And the only way to be successful in politics is not to be a little bit corrupt, right? Not to do deals with the devil knowing they're the devil, but to be the devil yourself, right? Mm-hmm. That's the only way to get ahead. And so it gives people the excuse to vote for terrible people because, the other person's no better, right? They just hide it better, but they're not actually better, right? And like, sorry, a person who leans left and actually believes in the democratic vote and the will of the people is objectively less scary than a guy who thinks the right things on paper, but does it the wrong way. Because, you know, the problem is, what happens when he starts doing something you don't like? Then you can't stop him. That's the problem, right?
Especially if you have undermined the system of checks and balances so much that there are none to stop
him. See, I actually think that people want the current system undermined. That was something I heard a lot with Trump supporters the first time around. The people that are, he's awful, but that's what we need. We need to burn it all down and rebuild something new, right? Now, this shows they have no awareness of what happens when a system is actually razed to the ground, like Yemen right now, you know, or like Russia, God knows how many times. A better, brighter thing doesn't rise up in its place. It's always something more corrupt. Right. I mean, after the terror, France got Napoleon. Right. Mm-hmm. They didn't get a democracy. And that's what's so scary about that thinking. But it's desperation. Right.
It is.
People aren't seeing democracy versus fascism. These are people that believe our current system is fascistic because they've been taught basically that it is in one way or another, right? This whole idea of privilege is so mistaught that it's so polarized now that some people believe that, you know, systemic discrimination, getting back to that, you know, conservative cognitive dissonance I was talking about before, it can't be the reasonable midpoint of, yes, systemic bigotry in many forms exists. It's not responsible for everything that happens to you.
Right.
Right. Which is the truth. You've got people who are either, it doesn't exist at all because I'm a white male and look, I'm poor. Nobody gave me nothing. Misunderstanding what it means. Right. Mm-hmm. Or somebody who is, you know, well, I didn't get ahead because of systemic racism. It's like, but you never submitted your portfolio. You never went for an audition. You didn't try. You spent all your time telling people why you couldn't do it because the system is against you. Yes, you are going to have to work way harder. I totally understand why a great many successful Black people are just mad as hell right now, because it was just too hard. Yeah. We can say that without insisting that you have no chance, right? But it just seems that so many people are beaten down by a model of looking at the world that we're now in a very deep pit, two sets of very deep pits, right? One pit is all the poor white guys or the previously middle-class white male way of life, right? That was always a fallacy. You know, mm-hmm. that post-war single income white picket fence way of living that the New Deal provided white men and any woman they didn't just want to get rid of for a newer model. But, you know, that was always not real. That was always propped up on debt spending. Mm-hmm. And
that's always, that's a very, very, you never spend yourself into debt.
Well, unless it's something like the coronavirus, you know, that was...
Emergencies are different in that sense.
Well, that's the problem with emergencies, right? And this is something that after the Second World War was an issue, and it's going to be an issue again with the Rona, right? In that, okay, deficit spending during a crisis makes sense. anybody who thinks that now is not the time to deficit spend, it's no different than you want to buy a house. Well, you don't have $1 million just lying around, so you get a mortgage. Yeah. Makes sense, right? Like it using a credit card because, you know, a pipe burst and you need to pay a plumber. These things make sense. These are rational acts. The problem after World War II is you had so many men they knew were coming back traumatized that instead of creating support systems where they could be absorbed into a free market economy, they shoehorned a solution. So they kicked all these women out of work and they found, wow, I actually can, you know, take care of my kids and keep my house clean and work. Wow. I'm just not waxing my floors 3 times a week, yeah. Which is amazing that anybody ever did that, as an aside. Like, talk about creating more work to fill the available space, right?
Yeah.
But instead of going, all right, we need to create jobs. We need to create wealth. I'm very heartened that Biden is the first president I can remember that is openly talking about creating wealth instead of redistributing wealth. It makes me happy, right? Because it's like, oh, he might actually understand something in his rambling uncle routine. But instead of figuring out a way to create opportunities for these men coming back, they just took away the women's job and gave it to the men.
Yeah,
it was forced, right? It was forced compliance by corporations for the war effort. And then the infrastructure projects that they did to create jobs, temporary jobs. That's the problem. Whenever the government does some big infrastructure thing, those are temporary jobs,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you want to keep that temporary job, you need to constantly keep moving to follow the temporary jobs. Those are not, no job is permanent. Granted, creative destruction is a thing, but most people would like to stay in a single job for 5 to 7 years, maybe, as opposed to 2 years. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so they created this unsustainable lifestyle in the 1950s. And of course, what happened? Stagflation, right? There started being the problems with, well, communist containment and what that required, and people started railing against unjust wars because they saw the inherent difference between what was going on with Korea and Vietnam compared to World War II. But also the Economic High Wire Act that was created in the 1950s was starting to crumble. And we're seeing that now as well. Instead of government, you know, forced compliance in terms of who got jobs and who had to stay home, now it's the debt cycle, right? It's people were told they could afford a certain amount of debt, and that turned out to be wrong. And that's not fair. If you want people to comply with a system, you have to earn their trust in the system. And the problem is right now we've got what? I mean, that happened when W was in office, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And we've never quite recovered
Nope.
from that subprime lending problem, right? And then, of course, Obama bailed out the auto industry, which may or may not have been a good thing, because it just seems like the cars that are being made don't match the cars that people actually want
mm-hmm.
or can afford. But we've got this ongoing thing of every solution the government finds for a problem now just seems to create more marginalization and more aggrievement. And I really think that's the core of all this cognitive dissonance, that, you know, you're a privileged person, you can do anything you want, and life is still far, far, far too hard. that they're internalizing a message of absolute privilege instead of a message of relative privilege, that they're getting cognitive dissonance because that's not matching their experience. And they're pissed as hell about it. And I can totally relate to that. I don't understand why they'd line up behind one of the guys responsible for that paradigm. I mean, the guys who created that system were guys like Trump. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, pretty much. Like,
I'm actually quite happy that the next president is going to be a guy who didn't go to an Ivy League school and grew up blue collar, right? Now, Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar, but he grew up pretty blue collar. Clinton had to do a lot of deals with the devil to rise up. Biden had to do the same thing. That weakens them in office because whatever reason people want, and this weakened Obama too, right? Like people want the white knight, right? Not skin color white, because obviously that's not Obama.
Right.
The knight in shining armor type. People want that. I don't understand why. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you've had generations of America has had an issue for the longest time of sort of enshrining cognitive dissonance, if you think about the for decades. You have the image of the rugged individualist, which became a caricature into more of the man-child who postures as an individualist instead of actually being one. Well,
that's an interesting observation.
And then you have, you know, you have that in conflict with the notion that the government is the proper solution for a lot of your issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we're speaking of legal issues, the issues of your rights being trampled, yes, the government has to be has to be part of the solution because that is their job.
That's what it's for. Yeah,
it's there to protect your rights. It doesn't give you your rights. Nobody gives you your rights. Your rights exist because of who you are, a human being, a sapient creature. The role of that, and that's something that a lot of people get wrong. Rights are not just given to you by a government. The government exists there to protect what's already there, what is inherent in your nature as a human being.
Yeah, but that's where the nuance comes in again too, right? That it's very hard to find the line between, first of all, people fight over what a right is way too much because of cognitive dissonance. They let their own personal discomfort. And like rights are something where you do have to get used to a certain amount of cognitive dissonance, right? Mm-hmm. Like for instance, me, myself, I have an inherent, I feel sick when someone's stoned. It makes me incredibly uncomfortable. Any drug use, I can really relate to Trump. Yes, I said that I can relate to Trump on this point. I do not like being around disgusting drunk people. See, I said disgusting. It's a disgust trigger, right? Like this is irrational. I recognize it's irrational. I recognize that drug use makes me profoundly uncomfortable. I still do not think people should be in jail for drug use. Agreed. Not use. I don't. That means my freedom of movement is restricted because I'm allergic to marijuana. So anywhere they're smoking pot, I can't go. I can't go to concerts. I can't go to a lot of house parties. I just can't. Because people don't ask before they spark up. They just do. I have my freedoms curtailed. I wish that was not the case. But am I going to say that people should be in jail to solve that problem for me? No. I have to recognize that, the people at this house party are kind of assholes. Do I really want to be associating with these people if I don't have to? No, moving on, right?
Yeah.
Rights are the one thing where you may personally find something distasteful. You have to let it happen because of a greater first principle at play, right? I don't know of anybody that likes the idea of abortion. I certainly don't. But there's a higher principle at play, that you cannot force a woman to basically be a baby factory for 9 months against her will without compensating her. And that is currently what the state makes women do if abortion is not legal. You know, if you want to make abortion illegal, women should be paid to be pregnant, period, end of story, right? Mm-hmm. That's the larger principle. Oh, you don't want to pay women to be pregnant? Well, just saying, right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That is an instance where it's hard, right? It's hard to see something you find disgusting going on. You know, I personally find religious fundamentalism deeply disturbing. That is someone's right. Because I give them their rights. I'd like them to shut up about any two consenting adults getting married. Thank you very much. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yes. We're in a state of shared cognitive dissonance. And yes, the lizard brain wants to stop the dissonance. Regarding that, would someone like me like to wipe all religious fundamentalism from the planet on a base level? Yeah, I would. Knee jerk, it would be very, very tempting. I know that's the wrong call.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I resolve that cognitive dissonance by going, no, there's a larger principle at play. Most people don't do that. Because it's delayed gratification. It's a process. You have to give yourself some time to be comfortable with the new idea. And people are terrible at getting comfortable with new ideas. Any discomfort whatsoever. You know, it's that third thing that causes cognitive dissonance. Effort.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
Like, oh, you may not get something right away. Right. Oh, God, there must be something wrong with me. I'm not getting my needs met immediately. That's a part of being a grown up. Right. And I don't know how you do an awareness campaign for that. You know, it's a difficult thing because people, I mean, if the coronavirus has taught us anything, it's that people have gotten really lazy.
Oh God, yes.
Like really lacking resilience. There's another example of, we have all heard the story, at least here. I don't know what the US is like, but at least here we all heard the stories when, you know, we got that wave of Syrian refugees and we heard the stories about these kids not being in school for 1 or 2 years, right? And they came here. And a lot of them are thriving, right? They're starting businesses and they're creating jobs and they're creating wealth. And people see those stories and yet they flip out because their kids may miss a couple months of school.
I know.
Like, I don't understand. And that though goes back to that, well, it's fine for them, but I deserve better. You know, oh, they should just be happy to be here. And that's really underlying the whole thinking, isn't it? Other people can come here and, oh, I really value their hardship as long as they're prepared to remain poor and vulnerable and I'm still better than them.
Yes.
Like, it's gross.
It really is. It's core. Super gross.
It's gross. And it's, you know, it's like you said, and this is where I struggle to find the line in my own philosophical critical thinking approach to government policy, that basic needs, like a basic standard of living, is essentially a right, right? That's the argument from proponents of universal basic income and things like that. But plenty is not a right. Where's the line, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, where is the line? What is the government required to provide in support of a person's rights so that they can engage on a level playing field in opportunity? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And especially now with this, I don't know if the mental health crisis is increasing or we're just aware of it, right? But especially with that in line and all these people arguing, you know, oh, this lockdown is affecting my mental health, therefore it must stop. That's a compelling emotional argument. In terms of reason, it's totally wrong, right? There are other things you can do to help people's mental health without doing policies that are going to make people sick.
Right.
And this is what I'm really struggling with, because I see a lot of people where they're coming to, and granted, all of this is subjective, right? But they're coming to what I believe to be the wrong conclusions, not because of the information they're working with, but because of the omission of data, right? They're leaving variables out. And all critical thinking is incomplete. None of us has complete information when we're making our decision making. But this is a unique case, right? Like any election, there's all stuff politicians are hiding. We have to go based on what's known.
Mm-hmm.
It's not possible to know every detail of a person's life, right? Case in point, Justin Trudeau did blackface before, or brownface, which I don't consider a thing. He did blackface once. He did that before he got elected the first time. We just didn't know about it. By the time it came to light that he did that, we'd already gotten more of a measure of the man. So we could be like, it was a stupid thing he did when he was younger. It was dumb. It was thoughtless. I don't think he's a racist. Whereas I think if that had come up the first time he won, he never would have been elected prime minister. He wouldn't. He was just less of a known commodity. People would not been able to tolerate that.
Mm-hmm.
That's how things work. And I think people are terrified of making the wrong choice. And so they end up making the really wrong choice. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like they're so afraid of being wrong, they end up being really wrong. And I don't know what to do about that. What do you say? Don't be afraid of being wrong. I understand why people are being afraid of being wrong. You know, this fear of cancel culture, again, because they don't have complete information, these stories of quote unquote cancellation are presented with very subjective, you know, cherry picked information about the circumstance. I get why people are scared, but scared people don't make good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to find some way of cutting the fear out. But I'm not going to tell somebody who's afraid of losing their house because of the loss of wages from coronavirus that they don't have that fear isn't real. Like that's, people get scared when that happens.
That's true.
You know, but then you get these, you know, then you get the allegedly small government conservatives piping up like Rand Paul. Which I swear his father gave him that name so no libertarian could say he was wrong ever, because you're anointed by the Rand, right?
Supposedly it's Rand. It was after Randall, but you know.
Bull. It's wrapping himself in the mantle of the Fountainhead. But I mean, there's a perfect example of a guy. Oh, you want to be John Galt, but you're actually, you know, James Taggart.
Nothing makes it, yeah.
Yeah. Probably not the best. Trump's more of a James Taggart.
He is. Trump is definitely a James Taggart type.
Yeah. But people don't see that because you have to dig deeper to see that metaphor. And that's the thing people need to understand. When we apply these fictional concepts, they are metaphors. They're just ways of explaining something in fewer words. And those metaphors have become so powerful in a world where everything seems to be so highly subjective,
mm-hmm.
that they're getting in the way, right? Like
it's when you let the shortcut basically... it's when you let the shortcut overcome all of the finer details, and then you can't really have a nuanced grasp of things.
Yeah, the fact that, what is it, like 600,000 Cuban Americans voted against the word socialism,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to really understanding whether the policies were actually socialist. Like, they weren't voting against the policies. They didn't know what they were.
Right.
They were voting against the idea of socialism. And you know what? I can't blame them based on what they came from. I mean, that's an example where dirty tricks just won. The negative ads permeated. The Trump campaign ran against figures with a lot of profile, but not as much power as people believe they had. So mm-hmm. they had a massive head start, because no matter who got the nomination, they were going to run against Bernie Sanders and AOC. They knew that, right? Yeah. And Biden, people say they didn't campaign enough in you know, Latino. I watched the Spanish language ads that the Biden campaign put out. They targeted ads. They got a different musician from a different culture. Like, they had Venezuelan musicians. They had Cuban musicians. Like, they were trying. Now, I think it doesn't help that their party was referring to people as Latinx. That's got to go away. But because they don't like that. Right. But some do, but a lot of the rank and file middle of the road voters are like, my abuelita cannot say Latinx. Why do you keep saying this? I keep hearing that. It's so strange. But it's not that the Biden campaign didn't try. It's not that they didn't try to reach out to Cuban Americans. That's the narrative that's being set. It's just that Trump's people had such a massive head start.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot, and people are blaming the Cuban Americans, right? I remember when Sanders ran against Hillary back in the day. People were saying then, if Sanders is the nominee, we will lose Florida. Period. End of story. They knew that.
Yeah.
There are some things that if you decide to embrace certain ideals, you have to accept the losses that come with that because you think you're going to make gains in other places. But again, losing hurts. Losing anything hurts. And it's so typical of the Democratic Party that they flipped Arizona, they flipped Georgia, they made gains in Texas, but they're acting like they're dying because they lost a share of the Latin American vote in Florida. It's just nuts, the negative framing in that party. But that's what happens when you've got a huge amount of cognitive dissonance, when you're thinking, we're not the better party, we're the only moral party. Right. That is the mindset of both of the U.S. political parties right now. Not we're better. We're the only one that's good.
Yeah.
And so how can people possibly vote in favor of evil? That's what they think. Like, that's what I've heard, that everybody who voted for Trump was a racist. It's like, well, a lot of people probably were. A lot of people, I heard, people who, it wasn't that they were going to vote for Trump, it's that a family member was going to vote for Trump because they had been sufficiently persuaded that Biden was just as bad. And so when two candidates seem both bad, people vote for the selfish decision. Because that's how they justify the fact they are voting for a guy. People know in their core Trump is racist. And Trump is sexist. And Trump is a lot of other really bad things. Trump is a transactional bigot. He will not have a problem with the type of person until he can wound somebody with their identity, right? Mm-hmm. So he may not have any conscious problem with a black person until he can put them down for being black. Though I think he actually does have a unique fear of black people. Just
he does.
My personal opinion.
Really strange.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't think he cares whether someone's gay. I think he may have some closeted gay tendencies himself. But if he can use that as a wedge, he's going to do it. And people know this, no matter how much they deny they do. They know this. They find ways to justify that, to soothe the cognitive dissonance that comes from, they like the Muslim ban, right?
Mm-hmm.
They like the wall. They like this idea of just keeping everybody out because they're frightened.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, the party has fomented the fear of the other for generations.
Yeah, so, and let me make it abundantly clear. The Muslim ban is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's bigoted and it's racist and it's ineffective. I mean, it's funny that people didn't make more of the fact that there were still terrorist attacks on military bases by people connected to Islamic extremism during Trump's tenure. Mm-hmm. It just, for whatever reason, people weren't hooting and hollering about that. It just kind of got swept under the rug, I think, because the crazy was just so strong. But it continued. The bans did not stop it. The clamping down on immigration did not cure America. It didn't even make it noticeably better. You know, all is protectionism. But people, when they're scared, they like the idea of just keeping everything away, right? And if they have to admit they're voting for a racist policy, they have to question whether you may not be racist yourself, but you're certainly perpetuating and condoning it.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't want to think about that. So they just don't think about the fact that Trump is racist. I mean, that's the problem with being so terrified of cognitive dissonance that you can't sit with it for a little bit. You end up doing the most expedient thing to get the yucky feeling to go away, and you end up making things worse.
Right. So in an attempt to even try to tackle the cognitive dissonance, well, not even try to tackle it, but to try to just get it to stop.
Yeah.
You end up just shoving the whole thing into the closet.
And everybody does this to an extent. It's mm-hmm. the way the human brain works, which is why it's important to unpack it and not. I totally get why people are dancing on Trump's political grave. I don't want anybody to feel like I'm shaming you for that. I get it, right?
It's the release of Schadenfreude. It's a German word, so of course.
It's not just Schadenfreude. It's not, I don't think anybody, okay, people are sort of happy about Trump's embarrassment here, but let's face it, he's going to go back to a very lavish lifestyle, and he probably will find a way to monetize his presidency in unscrupulous but very lucrative ways, right? I don't think America's ready to put an ex-president behind bars yet. Certainly not with 70 million people still having voted for him. So Trump will never really see consequences to what he did. But he can't do any more harm come January 20th, right? Like, at least that problem's solved. And I think a lot of people were actually very afraid that he was going to not leave. I think some people are still afraid he won't leave.
No, there's a whole bunch of people who don't want him to.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people who want to find a way to, you know, use faithless electors and stuff like that. It's just, it's absurd. After going, we won last time, even though they lost the popular vote, they now want to manipulate the electoral college system to get an outcome they want. But that's because, I mean, come on. The reason they worship Trump in the first place is that's the sort of tactics that he embodies, right? You know, I don't know if you watched much of The Apprentice, but
I never did because I've never liked the man.
Yeah, like it had as much to do with what will actually make you successful in business as, you know, cooking mama will make you a Michelin chef. Okay. It was, they made people memorize the Harry Potter houses and shit like that. It was ridiculous. Right. It got more absurd as the ratings started to crater in later seasons. But I mean, that kind of American myth-making has been around since the 80s, and people are really, really invested in that. I think because, you know, sort of that thing we were talking about earlier, that, okay, the system's corrupt and it's working against me, but I can still trick the system
mm-hmm.
if I'm ruthless enough. And that's another thing we have to kind of and this is why it's so sad that people kind of associate Ayn Rand and her writings with that sort of ruthlessness. That wasn't what she was about at all. Ayn Rand is misunderstood for being inadequately feminine. And
that's definitely a huge part of it.
Oh, there was nothing that condoned ruthlessness in her writings. That was something that guys like Steve Ditko took and grafted onto it. You know, it's very strange how a bunch of men got a hold of Ayn Rand's philosophy and basically mansplained objectivism to its like you know, like that's what happened. You're laughing because it's true, right? And we need that sort of idea of, you don't need to be, how do I put this, you don't need to throw away the well-being of your own family to invest in a fair system, because any system that asks you to do that is not fair, right? Mm-hmm. That's just basic critical thinking right there. That's how you overcome the cognitive dissonance of some of the choices that we're going to have to continue to have to make as we dig out from, because Trumpism's not going away. I know that's a cliche, but it's not.
It's not. No, this is something that we're going to have to deal with for a long time. Opening the gates to populism means that an entire section of the populace has been empowered to think and act in a certain way that is in many ways antithetical to any type of system that really respects rights.
Well, they've been screwed by the system, and they keep getting told the system is working in their favor. Like, let's face it, both sides do it. I hate the both sidesism, but, you know, the people going, rah, rah, rah. People have been complaining about affirmative action since Reagan, right? Since it was put in, people have been complaining about affirmative action, even though affirmative action was always intended to be just a stopgap. But, you know, the people who are like, affirmative action, it's not fair. And then the other people going, white privilege, it's not fair. At some point, and I had to do this myself with the rampant sexism in the entertainment industry. Okay. It's sexist. That's not going to change overnight. So I have a choice to make. Am I going to do my best and set reasonable expectations based on what I know about the system? Or am I going to find something else to do with my life because it's not worth it? And I happen to choose the navigation choice, but going, it's not worth it, would have been equally valid. And I probably would have made more money if I found something else to do with my life, but choice is made, right? This is what everybody has to do. We can't spend our whole life waiting for a utopia. They don't exist in the real world, right? If you need a utopia to do anything, you're never going to get anything done. However, it is because, like you said, the role of government is to protect people's rights. We do have to be prepared for a certain amount of change because people's rights are currently being infringed upon. And like you said, government doesn't grant rights. Government upholds rights.
Exactly. The government isn't here to give you rights. You already have those rights. It's only there to protect them.
Right. And I mean, because the abortion debate is framed as murder, that's a bit more of a gray area in some people's minds. However, the gay marriage thing, marriage equality, no, this should be settled. At this point, we should not still be fighting about this crap.
Yeah. I mean, of course, what happens there is that people like to conflate their religion and their government. And they conveniently pretend that gay marriage means ecclesiastical marriage. And it isn't.
No, I mean, we had that stupid civil union category in Canada for a while because it was secular marriage, which is the only type of marriage that counts as far as the state's concerned.
Pretty much.
Right? You know, the government doesn't care if you have a get. You need a legal divorce through the secular courts, right?
And it's, you know, Asher and I have the stance that the government shouldn't have any say in marriage at all, because it's nothing more than a contract. And the job of the government is to enforce legally binding contracts.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason marriage actually matters to the government is things like tax law.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. But
things that they have made.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, trying to encourage marriage, they made preferential tax laws that now make marriage more important.
Which is social engineering.
Right. But once you start down social engineering, you have to create equitable social engineering. And that's that. This is going to hopefully be the debate over the next 4 years, how to get to equitable, as opposed to the debate about whether the government has any business enforcing equality. The answer is resoundingly yes. Yes, it does. And I mean, that has nothing to do with the tax code for the most part, right? It's what's legally permissible in a right. free state.
It's the notion that all citizens have the same rights before the government, and that the government is not allowed to treat one part of the population as special over another part of the population.
And what that looks like is a matter for debate. The problem right. is we're not having that debate, because we're having the debate about whether it's the government's business at all to enforce rights. People treat the government as just a source of tax rates, and they ignore every other thing the government does, like school lunches. You know, I'm not sure anymore that that's the right way to reduce poverty. You know, because if mm-hmm. kids aren't in school, they're going hungry.
Right.
It's a flaw in the system. But that's a discussion for another time. I think we should wrap. What about you?
I think so. And there is, I think that we can say that there is an underlying layer of fear in all of this that tends to short circuit your judgment.
Well, thought police are coming for you.
They found me.
They found you.
You need to hide me in your attic now.
Oh dear, that's dark. Anyway, go ahead. Emotional support, Canadian, in 3, 2, 1. I think we really do need, and we may need a few episodes to unpack the fear thing.
Because yes.
It's real. And I don't know about you. That's my one complaint about I'm going to toot my own horn here. A lot of critical thinking writing is that it doesn't factor in the role of fear.
Yes.
And yes. Yeah.
A lot of critical thinking books and a lot of critical thinking classes, etc., sort of presuppose that the person starting the course is starting from a point of complete serenity.
Right.
They're not assailed by fear and anxiety.
Yeah.
And so it, the person in question is a lot less receptive to what is being told, especially if they come from, say, a family or a society where this fear, this type of fear mongering becomes kind of a tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I know that in Latin America, especially in my home country, catastrophizing is kind of like a national holiday.
It certainly has become sort of an accepted thing in a way that maybe it's not the keep calm and carry on thing,
mm-hmm.
which is bullshit for the record. Yeah. But yeah, the myths, the cultural myths are different. Maybe that's why people are so drawn to telenovelas.
Like yeah.
People, it's the cathartic experience, right?
It is. For example, on this, because it really does depend on how you have been trained, or have you trained yourself to face the notion of fear. It I'm trying to put this into words, because abstract thought into words is hard.
Yeah, no, it's true that certain strata of society, you know, the example of the Black Lives Matter movement has been struggling with the idea of performative grief, right? Yeah. They have to grieve in public, and they have to show their fear and their anguish in public, so people treat it as real. But, you know, there is a inherent dehumanization in that process that can be its own form of trauma, because they are required to do it. It's no longer an organic thing. They have to grieve in public, so it's treated as real and it's treated as valid. Even though, you know, I think most people would rather not have video footage of their worst moments being replayed over and over and over again, so white people can feel better about themselves.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of the problem that's happened, right? In the wake of all these people being very publicly murdered by police. It's a mirror neuron thing of white people feel good for caring, as opposed to actually going, these people are suffering, we need to do something.
Yes.
It just, that is an element that I can't be rational about. I don't know. I really have trouble, and maybe somebody can explain the other side of the idea of it's corrupted statistics. It's got to be that people don't accept that there's a problem in that regard. You know, it's just corrupted statistics, and some people are immune to seeing things another way because cognitive dissonance is too hard.
Cognitive dissonance is too hard for them.
And they're afraid. Like what you were saying, fear structures and cultures are real. Yeah. And, you know, I was raised in a family that encouraged me to be afraid of Black people. Like there was a particular way members of my family said the word Jamaican that was a pejorative. And fortunately that didn't stick. But there was definitely an enculturation that I had to resist.
We've got to be carefully taught, as the song says.
We do. We also have to be prepared to question what we have been taught.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be taught to question what we're taught.
And that's the hard part for a lot of people.
Yeah, because parents have an intense feeling of responsibility, rightly so. And they think they're bad parents when their children rebel. When that's not so, rebellion in your teenager indicates you may have raised a free thinker.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll wrap now. I do want to unpack the fear thing, because I think it might actually help people. We had to start with cognitive dissonance because I'm surprised we actually haven't covered this before now, because it's sort of a significant principle in the whole critical thinking paradigm. But one thing at a time. I was concerned we'd go for 3 hours on this topic just because there's so much to unpack. We didn't even get to the second reason that cognitive dissonance happens. That's how big a topic it is. You know, I'll let you know, decision-making inherently causes cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. There, we did it. Okay. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast. This has been Mouse. I'm Leanna. FUnetwork.tv. Become a patron if you enjoy our content. $1 a month, $5 a month. If you can afford it on COVID pay, goes a long way. And hang in there. Take moments. Don't knee jerk. We will help you through your fear in the coming weeks. For now, Mouse, as usual, you have the final word.
Here is, I would like to end with a quote by Seneca. Not Epictetus, but Seneca. What I advise you to do is not to be unhappy before the crisis comes. Some things torment us more than they ought. Some torment us before they ought. And some torment us when they ought to not torment us at all. We are in the habit of exaggerating or imagining or anticipating sorrow.
And it's funny because while you were reading that, I was totally distracted by being tormented in my own mind by, you know, the naked lady playing cards?
Yes.
Instead, they're philosophers.
Oh, my God.
So, like, epic titties, Sophoclit.
This needs to be made.
I'm just broken right now.
Yeah. This is something you made. This is something of your own making, Liana.
I did this to myself.
You did this to yourself.